He told the story of a squad of soldiers drilling beside a railway line. At a critical moment, the drill sergeant's attention was distracted, and he failed to give the order to halt. The soldiers were so well schooled to obey orders without question, they carried on marching right into the path of an oncoming train. Now, of course, I don't believe the story, but I did when I was 9. The point is that the preacher wished us children to regard as a virtue the soldier's slavish and unquestioning obedience to an order, however preposterous. Speaking for myself, I think we did regard it as a virtue. I think I wondered whether I would have the courage to do my duty by marching into the train, and I think I rather hoped I would. To be fair, I don't think the preacher thought he was delivering a religious message, more military than religious, from what I remember, in the spirit of Tennyson's Charge of the Light Brigade, which he may well have quoted. From the High Command's point of view, it would be madness to allow every individual soldier discretion over whether or not to obey orders. Soldiers are drilled to become as much like computers as possible. Computers do what they are told. They slavishly obey whatever instructions are properly delivered in their own programming language. This is how they do useful things like word processing and spreadsheet calculations, but as an inevitable byproduct, they're equally automatic in obeying bad instructions. They have no way of telling whether an instruction will have a good effect or a bad. They simply obey, as soldiers are supposed to do. It is their unquestioning obedience that makes computers vulnerable to infection by viruses and worms. A maliciously designed program that says, copy me to every name in any address list that you find on this hard disk, will simply be obeyed and then obeyed again by the other computers to which it's sent in exponential expansion. It's impossible to design a computer which is usefully obedient and at the same time immune to infection. Well, if I've done my softening up work well, you will already have completed the argument about child brains and religion. Natural selection builds child brains with a tendency to believe whatever their parents and tribal elders tell them. And this very quality automatically makes them vulnerable to infection by mind viruses. For excellent survival reasons, child brains need to trust parents and trust elders whom their parents tell them to trust. An automatic consequence is that the truster has no way of distinguishing good advice from bad. The child cannot tell that if you swim in the river, you'll get eaten by crocodiles is good advice, but if you don't sacrifice a goat at the time of the full moon, the crops will fail, is bad advice. They both sound the same. They are both advice from a trusted source, both delivered with a solemn earnestness that commands respect and demands obedience. The same goes for propositions about the world, about the cosmos, about morality, and about human nature. And of course, when the child grows up and has children of her own, she will naturally pass the whole lot on to her own children, using the same impressive gravitas of manner. On this model, we should expect that in different geographical regions, different arbitrary beliefs, having no factual basis, will be handed down to be believed with the same conviction as useful pieces of traditional wisdom, such as the belief that manure is good for the crops. We should also expect that these non-factual beliefs will evolve over generations, either by random drift or following some sort of analogue of Darwinian selection, eventually showing a pattern of significant divergence from common ancestry. Languages drift apart from a common parent, given sufficient time in geographic separation. The same is true of traditional beliefs and injunctions handed down the generations, initially because of the programmability of the child brain. And I'll mention this again in my second lecture. And now, here's a charming story from my newspaper, The Independent, at Christmas one year. In a school nativity play, the three wise men were played by Shadbreet Baines, a Sikh, Musharraf Khalil, a Muslim, and Adele Marlowe, a Christian, all aged 4. No, it is not charming, it is grotesque. How could any decent person think it right to label 4-year-old children with the cosmic and theological opinions of their parents? To see this, imagine an identical photograph with a caption changed. Wouldn't this be a candidate for prosecution as a mild form of child abuse? Yet, because of the weird, privileged status of religion, not a squeak of protest was heard, nor is it ever heard on any similar occasion. The Independent published only one letter of complaint from the Campaign for Real Education, whose spokesman said multi-faith religious education was extremely dangerous because, quote, children these days are taught that all religions are of equal worth, which means that their own has no special value. Just imagine the outcry if the caption had read, Shadbreet Bains, an atheist, Musharraf Khalil, an agnostic, and Adel Marlow, a secular humanist, all aged 4. In Britain, where we lack a constitutional separation between church and state, atheist parents usually go with the flow and let schools teach their children whatever religion prevails in the culture. The Brights. You know about the Brights. I haven't got time to go into it, but this is a new initiative to rehabilitate atheists in America by giving them a nicer sounding name. It's by analogy with the hijacking of the word gay by the homosexual community. So I am a Bright. We are the Brights. The Bright website, this is the point of the example, is very scrupulous in setting out the rules for children to sign. You can go and sign up. There's the website there. But they're very scrupulous about children, and they say, quote, the decision to be a Bright must be the child's. Any youngster who is told he or she must or should be a Bright cannot be a Bright. Can you even begin to imagine the Roman Catholic Church issuing such a self-denying ordinance? Our society, including the non-religious sector, I stress, has accepted the preposterous idea that it is normal and right to slap religious labels, but no other comparable labels, on tiny children. Please raise your consciousness about this and raise the roof whenever you hear it happening. A child is not a Christian child, but a child of Christian parents. Not a Muslim child, but a child of Muslim parents. Not a Jewish child, but a child of Jewish parents. And that terminology, by the way, would be an excellent piece of consciousness raising for the children themselves. It's not telling them what to think, but it would sow the seed of the idea that religion is something for them to choose or not when they become old enough to do so. I must again stress that the hypothesis of the programmability of the child brain is only one example. The message of the moths and the candle flame is more general. As a Darwinian, I'm proposing a family of hypotheses, all of which have in common that they do not ask what is the survival value of religion. Instead, they ask what was the survival value in the wild past of having the kind of brain which in the cultural present manifests itself as religion. And I should add that child brains are not the only ones that are vulnerable to infection of this kind. Adult brains, too, especially if primed in childhood, are vulnerable to charismatic preachers who spread the word far and wide among adults as if they were diseased persons spreading an epidemic. So far, the hypothesis suggests only that brains, for example, child brains, are vulnerable to infection. It says nothing about which viruses will infect. In one sense, it doesn't matter. Anything the child believes with sufficient conviction will get passed on to its children and hence to future generations. This is a non-genetic analogy of heredity. Some people will say it is memes rather than genes, and I don't want to sell mimetic terminology to you, but it's important to stress that we're not talking about genetic inheritance. What is genetically inherited, according to the theory, is the tendency of the child brain to believe what it is told. This is what makes the child brain a suitable vehicle for non-genetic heredity. Well, if there is non-genetic heredity, could there also be non-genetic Darwinism? Is it arbitrary which mind viruses end up exploiting the vulnerability of child brains, or do some viruses survive better than others? And this is where those theories that I dismissed earlier as proximate, not ultimate, come in. If fear of death is common, the idea of immortality might survive as a mind virus better than the competing idea that death snuffs us out like a light. Conversely, the idea of posthumous punishment for sins might survive, not because children like the idea, but because adults find it, or governments perhaps even find it, a useful way to control them. One could devote a whole lecture to listing religious ideas and examining the possible survival value of each. Note survival value for the idea itself, not survival value for the individual. I did a bit of this in my essay, Viruses of the Mind, originally written in honour of Dan Dennett and now reprinted in my latest book. But I have no time for that today. The important point is that, as I said, survival value doesn't have to have its normal Darwinian meaning of genetic survival value. We're not having our normal Darwinian conversation about why a gene survives in preference to his alleles in the gene pool. We're now talking about why one idea survives in the pool of ideas in preference to rival ideas. Let's go back to first principles and remind ourselves of exactly what is going on in Darwinian natural selection. The necessary condition is that accurately self-replicating information exists in alternative competing versions. George Williams has called them codices, singular codex. The archetypal codex is a gene, not the physical molecule of DNA, but the information it carries. Biological codices, genes, are carried around inside bodies whose qualities, phenotypes, they help to influence. The death of the body entails the destruction of any codices that it contains unless they have previously been passed on to another body in reproduction. Automatically, therefore, those genes that positively affect the survival and reproduction of bodies in which they sit will come to predominate in the world at the expense of rival genes. That's ordinary Darwinian natural selection. A familiar example of a non-genetic codex is the so-called chain letter, although chain is not a good word. It's too linear, doesn't capture the idea of explosive, exponential spread. Equally ill-named for the same reason is the so-called chain reaction in an atomic bomb. So let's change chain letter to postal virus and look at the phenomenon through Darwinian eyes. Suppose you receive through the mail a letter which simply said, make 6 copies and send to 6 friends. If you slavishly obeyed the instruction as a computer would, and if your friends and their friends too, the letter would spread exponentially and we'd soon be wading knee-deep in letters. But of course, most people wouldn't obey such a bald, unadorned instruction. You need something else. Suppose the letter said, if you do not, a voodoo will be placed on you. And there'd be various more and more sophisticated versions of that. Most of us still wouldn't send it on, but a small number of people would, and some sort of exponential takeoff might occur. We've probably all received examples of the letter that says, send money to people on the list, and eventually you'll reap an enormous fortune. Postal viruses also appeal to human sentiment. The most famous example is the Craig Shergold letter, which gained a new lease of life when the internet came along. In 1989, a 9-year-old British boy called Craig Shergold was diagnosed with a brain tumour. And somebody circulated a letter saying that Craig's ambition before he died was to get into the Guinness Book of Records for receiving the most Get Well cards. The letter asked people to send the boy a card and to send the requesting letter on to others. It was this last clause that turned the letter into a virus. Within a year, Craig had broken the record, and as a result of the publicity, his case fortunately came to the attention of an excellent surgeon who operated on him, and he's still alive. But the cards kept on coming. The internet kicked in, and by 1999, 250 million cards had arrived. Craig, who was by then 16, asked that they should stop. King Canute had as much success with the tide. Cards continued to flood in at a rate of about 300,000 per week. Various mutant versions of the letter are now in existence and circulating. At some point, Get Well card mutated to business card, or another strain of the virus to birthday card. Craig's age mutated from 9 to 7, perhaps more appealing, and for some reason from 7 to 17. But in any case, he's now 23. His name mutated many times. And the cards are still coming, in spite of repeated efforts by him and his family to stop them. The point of the story, of course, is that no genes are involved, yet postal viruses display an entirely authentic epidemiology, including the successive waves of infection rolling around the world and including the evolution of new mutant strains of the original virus. And the lesson for understanding religion, to repeat, is that when we ask the Darwinian question, what is the survival value of religion, we don't have to mean genetic survival. The conventional Darwinian question translates into, how does religion contribute to the survival and reproduction of individual religious people, and hence to the propagation of genetic propensities to religion? That would be the normal Darwinian way to put it. But my point is that we don't need to bring genes into the calculation at all. There is at least something Darwinian going on here, something epidemiological going on, which has nothing to do with genes. It is the religious ideas themselves that survive, or fail to survive, in direct competition with rival religious ideas. It's at this point that I have an argument with some of my Darwinian colleagues. Purist evolutionary psychologists will come back at me and say something like this: cultural epidemiology is possible only because human brains have certain evolved tendencies. And by evolved, we mean, of course, genetically evolved. You may document a worldwide epidemic of chain letters, of reverse baseball hats, an epidemic of copycat martyrdoms, an epidemic of total immersion baptisms. But these non-genetic epidemics depend upon the human tendency to imitate. And we ultimately need a Darwinian, by which we mean genetic, explanation for the human tendency to imitate. And this, of course, is where I return to my theory of childhood gullibility. I stress that it was only an example of the kind of theory I want to propose. Ordinary genetic selection sets up childhood brains with a tendency to believe their elders. Ordinary, straight down the line, Darwinian selection of genes sets up brains with a tendency to imitate, hence indirectly to spread rumours, spread urban legends, and believe cock and bull stories in chain letters. But given that genetic selection has set up brains of this kind, they then provide the equivalent of a new kind of non-genetic heredity, which might form the basis for a new kind of epidemiology, and perhaps even a new kind of non-genetic Darwinian selection. I believe that religion, along with chain letters and urban legends, is one of a group of phenomena explained by this kind of non-genetic epidemiology, with the possible admixture of non-genetic Darwinian selection. If I'm right, religion has no survival value for individual human beings, nor for the benefit of their genes. The benefit, if there is any, is to religion itself. In my second lecture tomorrow, I shall switch from the science of religion to the religion of science. Given that religion exists for whatever reason, does science itself behave like a religion, as is sometimes alleged? I shall argue that there are interesting points of overlap between science, aspects of science, and aspects of religion. But you won't be surprised to learn that finally, I don't think there is a religion of science. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Richard. And I think I speak for the Harvard community as a whole in expressing our appreciation for the clarity and rigor of your argumentation, the elegance of your prose, and the passion of your commitment to reason and logic. Needless to say, I agree with most of what you said today. I agree that that religion is a problem in psychology that psychologists have not addressed in sufficient detail, that the question of the functional value of religion, given its costs, is an acute one, and that the answer is likely to be found in religion being a byproduct of cognitive abilities that evolved for other purposes. I'm going to perhaps add two friendly amendments to the particular hypothesis that you advanced as to what aspect of our psychology gave rise to religion as a byproduct. You emphasized the receptiveness of children to tutelage from their parents, which creates an opening for the fantastic beliefs that we call religion. But I've been, as a psychologist interested in children, I've become interested in the problem that often we as psychologists, and I think as intellectuals at large, tend to give parents credit where the phenomena of cultural transmission might more suitably be attributed to the influence of peers. Now, the reason that I think, is a widespread illusion that parents are what socialize children is that in most circumstances the influence of parents and the influence of peers are confounded. You've got American parents and American peers passing information along to American children and turning them into Americans, and you've got Yanomamo parents and Yanomamo peers as the environment of Yanomamo children, and they end up with Yanomamo beliefs and values. And so, as the psychologist Judith Rich Harris has emphasized, you need to look at the cases in which the influence of parents and peers is unconfounded, such as immigration. And when you think about the effects of immigration, of separating the belief system of the parents from the peers, it starts to, I think, give one an increased appreciation for perhaps peers as the dominant influence. As a psycholinguist, this impressed me when I thought of how children acquire their accent and dialect. We think of the acquired aspect of language as coming from parents, but when you think about the immigrant situation, the children will end up, in virtually every case, with the accent of their peers, not their parents. So if a parents move from Britain to the Deep South, their child will end up with a Southern accent, not a British accent, and vice versa. And this leads one to wonder whether accent is an index of the vector of socialization more generally. And when one applies that to the case of religion, I find it becomes more and more compelling. So examples. In the immigrant situation, again, the one in which parents and peers are unconfounded, the great obsession with religious parents who immigrate is assimilation. Most salient with, say, the Jews in America, but for other ethnic minorities, that the imprinting that children get from their parents as children seems not to take, that with every successive generation, the parental line of transmission peters out and children become more like their peers, less like their parents. The exceptions that prove the rule are cases in which parents succeed in propagating their mimetic lineage, such as the Amish, such as the ultra-Orthodox Jews, who take great pains to sequester their children from the larger community of peers and ensure that they grow up only with peers with the same belief system. Another example, which I think would be a fruitful proving ground for theories of the psychology of religious transmission, would be cults, in which one sees the origin, not just the propagation of religious beliefs. My understanding of the dynamics of cults is that the prime technique is to surround the new recruit, to immerse them in a group of peers, to cut them off from the larger environment so that the new set of norms and shared beliefs in lateral transmission comes from this claustrated circle, and that's the effective way in which cults begin. The second friendly amendment is on the content of religious belief. You spoke of the properties of mind that allow particular beliefs to find fertile ground. The other side of the story is those aspects of mind that allow people to create contagious beliefs to start with, and many of which, as you pointed out, have common properties. Now, in one of your earlier books, I believe it was The Blind Watchmaker, you spoke of the what Dan Dennett has called the design stance, the tendency of human minds to engage in reverse engineering. You come across a watch, you assume there must be a watchmaker. You come across an eye, you assume there must be an eye maker, namely God. And it might be this intuitive reverse engineering or design stance that makes one recurring component of religion, namely a creator, intuitively plausible. I'd like to add one other aspect of our psychology that might be necessary for an explanation of the content of religious beliefs, which is that just as we have a design stance or an intuitive reverse engineering, we also have what Dennett calls an intentional stance or an intuitive psychology, what psychologists call theory of mind. That is, when we interact with other people, we don't treat them as robots or wind-up dolls, but we impute minds to them. We assume that their behavior is caused by beliefs and desires in an entity called a mind, which we can't observe directly, but we infer from their behavior. It's been suggested by a number of cognitive anthropologists that some religious beliefs spring from our intuitive psychology, namely from the core intuition that other people have a mind that housed in their body that we cannot observe directly. It's a short step to thinking about minds that happen to be free of bodies, namely souls, ghosts, and so on. Moreover, until recently, there was good evidence for a dualist theory that there exist minds which can exist separately from bodies, such as dreams, where some part of us, some sentient part of us, appears to be walking up and about in the world while we know that our body has been in bed the whole time, and death, where some animating force that was present in a body just a few hours ago appears to have departed it, accounting for the empirical phenomenon that the body is now lifeless. And I believe that you wrote in The Blind Watchmaker that until Darwin came along, the argument for God from design was actually quite compelling, that Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist by providing an alternative to our intuitive reverse engineering. I'd like to suggest as a possible addendum that neuroscience made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist in another regard, namely that a theory which otherwise would be quite compelling, namely that there are minds that are separate from bodies, is only refuted by the alternative that organized behavior comes from the intricately complex activity of hundreds of billions of neurons, a fact that our ancestors could not possibly have discovered before the advent of modern neuroscience. Hence, religious beliefs that were more than 100 or 150 years old before the advent of neuroscience were not just compelling, but almost irresistible, given our tendency to impute minds to other people. And so the question, if it is a question, I suppose, is whether these two amendments to the example that you gave of how to do a scientific psychology of religion would be congenial.
Well, thank you, Steve, for those very helpful, constructive suggestions. I have, of course, read The Blank Slate, and it's just slipped my mind, the point about parental influence being not necessarily so important as peers, and I feel remiss about that. I'm still curious about how it is that the illusion, if such it be, of longitudinal transmission, whether it's of accents or religions or whatever it is, gets transmitted longitudinally. And I suppose on the peer model, it would have to be that when a child, say, goes to school or joins a peer group, there is a kind of longitudinality of transmission, because elder peers who are just about to leave the school or just about to leave the peer group are the most influential on younger ones. And so the model of longitudinalness remains, even though we're no longer talking about parents influencing children. We're talking about elder peers influencing younger peers. The other points I found most illuminating are the things about reverse engineering, the design stance, and the intentional stance. It seems to me entirely plausible that those two very largely account for much of the impulse towards religion, the design stance and the intentional stance, the feeling that we have, the way our psychology constructs models of the world which give agency to entities, which work very well for other human entities, and they are by far the most economical way of accounting for the behavior of other humans, to assume that there is an agent in there who is making decisions, has intentions, and so on. And it's entirely natural that we should do the same projection onto inanimate objects like thunder and lightning and waterfalls and so on. So I think that's a very, very helpful suggestion. And the analogy to my statement about Darwin making it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist, that neuroscience does in another way, I also find a very helpful constructive suggestion. So thank you very much.
That was biologist Richard Dawkins of Oxford University, with additional comments by evolutionary psychologist Steven Pinker of Harvard. Both have written a number of books which are widely available. Thanks to Martin Volker of No U-Turn Radio in Boston for that recording. Dawkins clearly sees science as an uplifting and enlightening pursuit, but its role in society is actually more equivocal. Practical applications of science have led to some of the most potentially environmentally devastating and socially reactionary outcomes, such as, for example, nuclear power and weaponry, and our burgeoning surveillance society. We'll conclude the program with another installment of our ongoing reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals in the soul-battering system that shapes their lives, by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000, that addresses how the system of professional employment and training results in producing intellectual workers who will subordinate their principles and creativity to the conservative ideology of the corporate hierarchy. This week, we conclude Chapter 7 on Opportunity, which has been exploring the unsatisfying and stratified nature of the modern workplace. Beginning with the next subsection titled Selection as a Political Process. The professional's watchword seems to be extreme political caution, and indeed radicals are rare at the professional level in any field. Is the political subservience of those who are deemed most qualified just a coincidence? I maintain that there is no coincidence. Being positioned to serve the establishment is an important component of qualification, at least from the establishment's point of view. And because the establishment runs the game, The criteria for qualification embody its point of view. I hold that political discipline is a necessary requirement for one to be deemed a qualified professional. Of course, this discipline alone is not sufficient for qualification, but it is by far the most societally significant requirement in that it distinguishes the professional from the skilled non-professional. From the point of view that qualification criteria favor one or another political orientation, the affirmative action criteria used for the 16 positions at the UC Davis Medical School represent not lower standards, but politically different standards. Opponents of affirmative action would have us view the 16 positions as political and the other 84 as going according to merit. We will see that the 84 are no less political than the 16. In general, we will find that the system demands a high price, a political price, of all those it allows to work as professionals. The important issue in choosing professionals, then, is political orientation. To say this is not to advocate the selection of professionals on a political basis, but to simply recognize that the system of training and employment already does so. My goal isn't to, quote, inject politics into the process of political qualification, but to uncover and fight the bias already in operation, the bias against the underrepresented majority. To fight this bias will require an uphill battle all the way. Cultural and news media, ranging from newspapers and novels to television and movies, describe a society that selects its professionals according to merit. The only time the selection of professionals is treated as a political issue is in discussion of the allocation of scarce opportunity, usually professional school admissions. Even then, it is taken for granted that any politics end after admission, and that the ultimate certification to work as a professional is given or denied on the basis of a straightforward evaluation of the individual's technical skills. The notion that the individual's attitude, values, and orientation toward the underrepresented majority should play an important role in this evaluation, as the example of doctors might suggest, is rarely discussed in the media. When it is, the discussion is usually limited to special cases, such as the question of whether or not producing more black doctors will increase the number of doctors working in poor black neighborhoods. The notion that professional qualification is inherently political does not even enjoy a refutation. That political considerations already play a crucial role is simply kept outside the universe of debate. Recent history saw the issue of the attitudes and values of professionals break into the open most dramatically in China. During the Cultural Revolution there in the 1960s, non-professionals turned the tables on professionals by joining the ongoing red versus expert debate in large numbers. The issue was what to emphasize in evaluating professionals: their politics or their expertise. For people in socially influential positions, university professors, for example, this was a period of intense scrutiny, and many were driven from their privileged spots, at least temporarily. To this day, the U.S. press uses an openly denunciatory tone whenever it mentions these events. By using this tone within reports that are intended to be taken as objective, the media proclaim that Americans are unanimous in their outrage over the way the intellectuals were treated in China. This outrage is certainly characteristic of American intellectuals, who with the slightest reminder still hotly denounce the treatment of their counterparts in China received at the hands of the masses. As this has been well publicized, Some of the Chinese youth brigades went beyond militant but nonviolent means. However, the comfortable American intellectuals who denounce them show little understanding of the rage that fueled the violence. But even the nonviolent aspects of a cultural revolution rile up American intellectuals. They talk about the sending of professionals to do manual work on farms or in factories for 5 years as if it were a crime against nature, the work itself a living nightmare. And they ridicule the notion that professionals can learn from the peasants. American non-professionals, on the other hand, many of whom have been known to spend their entire lives doing farm or factory work, don't get so worked up about the dissing of experts in China. Perhaps they are intrigued by the idea of challenging the roles of professionals in our own society. Despite their strong feelings about it, American intellectuals generally understand the red versus expert debate. Most see it as part of an attempt by leftists to introduce politics into the work of professionals. If this seems familiar, it is because we saw the same misunderstanding before in those who argue against affirmative action by saying they want professional school admissions to remain unpolitical. We will see that the red versus expert debate arises from a recognition that the work of the professional is already political in nature. The move to discuss professional qualification in openly political terms represents a rebellion against the conservatism that pervades the professional's work. One can truly understand the red versus expert debate only by coming to understand these politics. That means identifying the particular values and attitudes that coincidentally accompany the expert's technical qualifications, and seeing how these values and attitudes make it possible for the individual to be employed as a professional. To have a complete picture, one should also understand how professionals are political in their very origins. How the requirements the system imposes for certification as a qualified professional are political in nature, and by what mechanism the favored political orientation is imposed. I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, and going on with the final subsection of Chapter 7, The Instrument of Selection. Anyone skeptical about a professional training system that claims to be politically neutral should examine that system most carefully at the point where it examines the would-be professional most closely. Training programs in almost every field make sure they have a well-defined point somewhere along the path to professional qualification at which they subject the candidate to intense scrutiny. The candidate usually encounters this as a very formidable and highly technical and thus seemingly neutral examination that he or she must pass to be allowed to continue. The professional qualifying examination is a hurdle that a significant fraction of candidates never pass. A professional qualifying examination is a long test that few aspiring professionals could escape. It's not an exaggeration to say it is much easier to dodge the draft during the war than it is to dodge this test and become a professional. In both cases, the stakes are high. With the exam, the candidate's entire future working life is at stake. Anyone who is not passed is either kicked out of the professional training program or barred from entering it, depending on the profession. Candidates so failed have virtually no chance for careers as professionals in their chosen fields. The large institutional employers require professional certification, and it is becoming more and more difficult to pursue a career outside the large institutions. Careers in science are particularly restricted in this way. Almost all positions for scientists are within universities, government, and large corporations. The PhD degree is increasingly required for the interesting jobs, especially in the fields most centered in research universities and government laboratories. Thus, most people hired to do basic research in biology or physics have PhDs, whereas research employment in engineering or computer science is less exclusionary. Would-be geologists, economists, chemists, historians, mathematicians, psychologists, biologists, political scientists, physicists, and so on, that is, students in fields where the advanced degree plays the role of a professional license, must take the professional qualifying examination after they have been in graduate school 1 to 3 years, depending on the field and the training institution. Graduate students know the test by various names: the qualifier, qualifying examination, comps, comprehensive examination, orals, oral examination, or prelims, preliminary examination, to mention a few. The ordeal typically consists of multiple written tests administered over a number of days, followed by an oral test. In other fields, as explained earlier, one must formally demonstrate some of the final set of professional qualifications just to be permitted to enter the professional training program. Thus, even though he or she is probably a college graduate, the aspiring doctor, lawyer, dentist, optometrist, veterinarian, or corporate manager, for example, agonizes over taking the MCAT, New Medical College Admission Test, the LSAT, Law School Admission Test, the DAT, Dental Admission Test, the OCAT, Optometry College Admission Test, the VAT, Veterinary Aptitude Test, or GMAT, Graduate Management Admissions Test. In other fields, the GRE, Graduate Record Examination, plays a similar role. Whether the examinations are given after a few years of graduate school or before professional training begins, they are a crucial part of the mechanism that opens or closes the gate to a career as a professional. I consider all of them to be professional qualifying examinations. Professional qualifying examinations should not be confused with licensing examinations, which are taken upon completion of professional training. This latter test plays a much smaller role in deciding who will be a professional and who will not. Few students emerge from professional training only to find themselves barred from practicing their profession due to failure on a licensing test. Even the student who has low MCAT scores, for example, but qualifies for admission to medical school anyway because of family influence or donations, is almost assuredly going to get through medical school and pass the licensing examination, the national medical boards, and become a doctor. The hard part is getting in to medical school. Investigations in the 1980s found quite a few people skipping medical school altogether by buying foreign medical school degrees and using them to go directly into hospital training programs in the United States. Two such, quote, graduates were described in Chapter 3. Even these people, from what they learn in the clinical training, pass the licensing exams and get permits to work as doctors. The significance of the licensing test as a gatekeeper varies from field to field, though it is never as significant as the qualifying examination. The licensing test is probably most significant in law, the fabled bar exam, or architecture, and least significant in the very large number of fields where the qualifying examination is given during graduate school. In fact, in these latter fields, the examination given to award the license, the advanced degree, is rarely more than a ritual. The defense of dissertation, as it is called, is a ceremonial examination that almost no one fails. The crucial juncture is qualification, not licensing. Qualifying examinations themselves are very revealing documents. Because of their major role in the very serious business of selection, qualifying tests must contain information on the central goal of all the study that leads up to them. In fact, those who set the goals often do so through qualifying examinations. Although these exams come immediately after many years of schooling, their purpose is not to document how much was learned. Rather, they are administered in order to measure the skills that are considered important in the professional. The difference is more than a matter of labels or interpretation. While an achievement test and a selection exam may look the same, they have opposite power relationships to the curriculum. The former, like a glorified final exam, is defined by the curriculum. The latter, like an admissions examination, caters to the needs of the institution for which it selects and ends up defining the curriculum that leads up to it. Through this backwash effect, qualifying examinations have more influence over the curriculum than do the teachers themselves. By simply analyzing these exams, one can learn a lot about the goals of the years of training that precedes them. Those who write qualifying examinations have tremendous influence over the curriculum. If they impose a ridiculous examination, an equally ridiculous curriculum will appear immediately to prepare students for it. One striking example of this is well known to people in the many developing countries with British or French-style educational systems. Even after national independence, admission to and awarding of degrees from local secondary schools and local and foreign universities were governed by examinations with questions not even pretending to reflect local concerns. Thus, in the British colonies and former British colonies of Africa, for example, students could be found studying the geography of the English lowlands, English literature, and European history. Some advanced students had to study such topics as the social and economic history of Tudor England. African graduates had to know about Charles Dickens, the succession of ruling monarchs, and the Battle of Waterloo. They studied all of this instead of learning about African ecology, culture, language, and history in order to pass the all-important examination. The schools served the interests of business owners in the developed world by helping to prepare a class of locals with whom the colonists could comfortably do business. In recent years, alternative topics have replaced some of the most obviously elitist sections of these selection examinations. However, examinations still reign supreme, dictating the curricula in primary schools, secondary schools, and colleges in much of the developing world. Progressive teachers in these countries have had little power as individuals to reform the curriculum, even in their own classrooms, because to do so would leave their students less well prepared for the all-important measure. Such teachers must content themselves with stealing a few minutes here and there to teach what they think is important. The World Bank, from its headquarters in Washington, wields great power in the developing world's educational systems. With education projects underway in 87 countries, the bank is the world's largest single source of education policy advice and external funds for education. One thing the bank wants to do is to take advantage of the influence of examinations to support curricula of its own liking. It apparently wants developing countries to select students for secondary and higher education, and therefore for the highest positions in their countries on the basis of the students' ability to answer questions that look a lot like those that appear on American aptitude tests, such as the SAT. I will not analyze why the bank wants to staff underdeveloped countries with such people, except to note that the tests favor technocrats over visionaries. That is, people who tend to innovate safely within assigned systems, over people who tend to question assigned systems. Interestingly, the bank's education division claims that in the developing countries, unlike in the industrialized countries, such tests do not favor the children of the wealthy. In any case, the bank knows that you can control the school curriculum of an entire nation simply by controlling the crucial qualifying examinations. According to a report published by the World Bank on an experience in Kenya, quote, "In the schools, examinations are never neglected. For the last 2 years leading up to any selection examination, the effective curriculum of the class is defined not by the official syllabus or the official textbooks, nor by what the teachers were taught during their last in-service course, but by the content of the most recent selection examination papers. The topics which teachers choose to teach and the methods by which they teach them are determined more by the nature of the terminating examination than by the specifications of the formal curriculum. The aim has been to harness the backwash effects of the examination to constructive purposes, so that the aims of the curriculum developers are buttressed and not sabotaged." Close quote. So, too, in professional training programs, the qualifying examination is the cold bottom line. Analyzing qualifying examinations is not easy. But by looking directly at the bottom line, you can cut through the myths and popular images that surround and mystify a profession, and in this way get the least distorted picture of what the years of study are all about. And that was the conclusion of Chapter 7, Opportunity, from our ongoing reading from the book Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000 by Roman and Littlefield. Schmidt is a doctor of physics who worked for 19 years as a writer and editor of Physics Today. He was fired from his job after publishing this book and is now the subject of an international letter-writing campaign from the scientific community to help him get his job back. For more information on the campaign and on Disciplined Minds, visit disciplinedminds.com. Thanks to Chris Sturr, Indie Media, and Martin Volker for their contributions to this week's program. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Happy New Year. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome.